The Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. Colleagues, today is June 17th, 2015. We're convened for the purpose of public hearing on House Bill 3225, a public hearing on House Bill 2621, and a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3503. We're going to go in that order, 3225 first, then 2621 and 3503. And I think what I will do is I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3225 and also a public hearing on House Bill 2621 so that the legislators who are here can all go first and go on to other duties if they so wish. So let's bring up Representative Barbara Smith Warner first. And Representative Johnson, are you guys on the same side of this issue, or should we keep you separated?
As always,
really?
Sure.
That's right. As always, right.
Fine.
And hurt.
Oh, man.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, colleagues. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I represent House District 45, Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. And to my right, as always,
is nicely done.
Thank you.
State Representative Mark Johnson from House District 52.
So, colleagues, we are here to speak to you today about House Bill 3225A, which comes to you originally from the Energy and Environment Committee. It then went to Rules, where we did some really significant work on an amendment, and now it comes before you on Ways and Means. And we are just here to strongly urge its support. I'm going to give you a little background on kind of where we got to, and then let Representative Johnson share his thoughts as well. So as I think, as I'm sure you've heard about in the media and other places, the increase in domestic oil production and transportation over the last 5+ years has been really significant. Nationally, between 2010 and 2012, the transport of oil by truck went up 38%, by barge went up 53%, and by rail went up over 400%. Just in Oregon, ODOT figures show that the carloads in Oregon that have gone through Oregon have increased 247% between 2005 and 2013. So this is a significant, this has the potential for significant impacts on our state because railroads traverse 15 Oregon counties, 35 house districts, 80 fire districts, and 10 of the 13 state hazardous material response team regions. In 2014, the state fire marshal did a survey of its regional response emergency response teams to say, how prepared are you to respond to an oil by rail or other hazardous material by rail incident? And the results came back as not sufficiently prepared. So that's where we started with on this. And as you may or may not know, the ability to do state policy on anything having to do with rail transport, it's a very narrow window. Federal preemption is a powerful thing. The Interstate Commerce Clause is a powerful thing. And so really, it was a very narrow you know, we had to really wind our way very carefully in order to establish a way to let the Oregon State, to get the Oregon State Fire Marshal to be able to coordinate response and plan for a sufficient response to these incidents. So what you have before you is where we got to through a lot of close work between the railroads, a number of representatives, some other stakeholders, and what House Bill 3225 will do is it authorizes the Oregon State Fire Marshal to coordinate contingency planning and training in preparation for an incident involving the transport of crude oil. And under this bill, the fire marshal will adopt a plan to address incidents that occur during the transport of hazardous materials by rail, to provide ongoing training for state and local and first responders, and to establish the location and coordination of response materials across the state. It will also set up a system by which the fire marshal does a regular survey of all of the equipment and materials that are located around the state, does regular training exercises, both tabletops and actual exercises, with local first responders, and reports back to the legislature regularly about that status. What 3225 will do do is your role, your very important role in this, is to provide the funding so that the fire marshal can take on that new responsibility. Because the kind of gaps in responsibility that were identified through that fire marshal survey, there's a range of them. And what 3225 does is it demonstrates that the state has a role in addressing this. And so by our contribution, hopefully with your approval, to allow the state fire marshal to play this coordinating role. At the same time, as part of those negotiations, the railroads were very involved and got and came to, and we agreed that there's shared responsibility here. And so they, in response to that state fire marshal survey, have also committed to provide a number of additional resources that will enable, that will help us to be able to respond better to these incidents. There's some materials that you have before you on OLIS. Their commitment on materials, specifically foam trailers in a variety of places around the state, scholarships to trainings in Pueblo, Colorado, which is kind of the gold standard of hazardous material by rail training, and also provision of some equipment that we can do these same trainings in the state. This is a very important element because a lot of these folks, it's not just getting the paying to have the people go to Pueblo, it's the overtime and the lost time that they that you have to account for when you're going to these trainings. So a big part of this is enabling a lot of this training to go to happen in the state, across the state, with these different local areas. And I would like to particularly call out Cindy Robert from Union Pacific, who is really thoughtful and creative throughout this whole process. And all three of the railroads that we worked with, UP, BNSF, and PNW, are all on board with the bill and their additional supports. We are ready and eager for you to vote on this whenever you wish. And with that, I will turn it over to my colleague.
Well done. Co-chairs and committee members, again, Mark Johnson, House District 52. I live in a part of the state, or I represent a part of the state and live there too, in the Hood River and the Columbia Gorge, where rail safety is a real preeminent concern. My city council in Hood River took a vote a while back indicating their concern about oil trains. The Columbia Gorge Commission has gone on records indicating that they were also concerned about the possibility to damage to the natural resource via some unfortunate incident. So the interest is high, the anxiety level has been high as well, but I really think this bill before you is a huge step forward to alleviate those fears and to put in place some really definite, concrete actions and support services that I think are a great step forward. And again, I think giving the state fire marshal the ability to coalesce the whole response, go through one central agency to coordinate responses and give them the ability and authority that they need to marshal support as they need it and to interdict any of these unfortunate incidents is huge. So this is a great step forward to just again clarify terms of lines of communication, lines of response. It's fabulous. But I also want to say that I think this other document, and I hope you do have it on OLIS, the Collaborative Rail Safety Agreement, is really a huge step of good faith by the rail carriers to come forward to provide resources and then to spell out where they will be deployed, who will have access to them, so that everybody's on the same page, knowing, again, in the unfortunate incident that something should happen, that that there's a way forward to make sure that these incidents don't get out of hand. But it's really been an eye-opening experience for me to have a chance to be a part of this process and just learn more about what the railroads actually already have in place, because again, they have no interest in having something happen that's going to be a bad incident. So they are proactively doing a lot of great things that just people don't see and they don't realize. But again, I just want to say hats off to the railroads for their good faith and participation in this. But I would just add some closing thoughts here that I still think we need to have a more concerted multimodal effort regarding hazardous cargo within the state of Oregon. We're just talking about rail here, but we also have a lot of hazardous things, obviously, on our roads and potentially in our waterways as well. And I think we need to expand this effort into all modes to where we can really make sure that public safety is taken into account. So with that, I'll be quiet and happy to answer any questions. But again, good to work with a good representative here and appreciate her cooperation and coordination with us.
All right. I thought now would be a good time for Julie to talk about the fiscal impact of this bill.
Thank you, Senator Shields, Representative Williamson, and committee members. House Bill 3225 has a fiscal impact in the 15-17 biennium of about $365,000. The state fire marshal estimates that it would need a program analyst position to coordinate, as Representative Johnson was saying, the outreach and develop the spill response plan in conjunction with all of the local public safety jurisdictions in the areas that are affected. Additionally, the state fire marshal would need some funding for conducting exercises and training and providing support for those local public safety organizations.
Any questions?
Mr. Kutcher, will the fire marshal be testifying, or is he going to come up?
Yes.
Okay. I'll hold my question. Thank you.
All right. And I think since we've only got one other person, Rep. Reardon, if it's okay with you, we'll just get the fire marshal up and then have you up next. Could we please bring up Jim Walker?
Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, representatives of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Walker. I work for the Office of State Fire Marshal. I'd really like to start off by just really appreciating a lot of the really good work that was done by Speakers Kotek, Representative Johnson, and Representative Smith-Warner. About a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, it was identified to us that there was this potential concern or a potential problem out there, and that was with the shipment of crude oil around the country. And there's been a lot of incidences that have occurred that have really made us concerned about it. And so what this committee did was they got together and they started analyzing what is the issue, what is the problem. And it came down to communities not feeling like they were equipped to be able to respond. Also felt like they didn't have the significant amount of training that they would need, and that there was no real overall planning process for this. There's an awful lot of different plans out there, but nobody was consolidating them, and nobody was really working together to come up with one plan in case that incident did occur. So this group identified all of those things, and they put the responsibility on the state fire marshal's office to make sure that we coordinated that planning with all of those local responders. It's a really good fit for our office as well, because we're responsible. USDOT gave the responsibility to our office to actually report on the movement of train trail travel. So we already do that. We have the 13 regional hazmat teams that we oversee as well. So it just kind of puts that planning, the response, and that community awareness in the place that it really should preside. So,
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. In terms of what Representative Johnson was bringing up, I live in Troutdale, and so not only do we have the mainline UP, as does a lot of folks up east of us, but we also have I-84. And there is a large amount of truck traffic that's carrying volatile chemicals. And so is there going to be a chance to expand this so that we are covering in a very holistic way, not just rail, but all of the things that are moving up and down the gorge?
Co-Chair Shields, Representative Gorsuch, the way that the program currently works is that the 13 regional hazmat teams are equipped and they are positioned around the state for exactly that, and that's for the transportation types of incidences. We've just never really been fully trained or prepared with the right equipment to be able to do rail because of the volatility of the oil that's being carried.
Okay, follow up.
And
can you tell us where the state of Washington is on all of this, since they're just across the water from us?
The state of Washington doesn't have nearly the system that we have in place to do what we do. They rely heavily on the larger fire departments throughout the state to be able to equip themselves. And it's extremely expensive to equip hazmat teams with the equipment that they would need to have. So they have some larger departments that are equipped, but they do not have state coverage like we do.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Croucher.
Mr. Chair, could I?
Please.
Thank you. Again, Barbara Smith-Warner. I just wanted to address that briefly because of the gorge in particular question. Water transport is an entirely different creature.
Right.
There is actual federal language that allows for a coordinated response system that is between the feds and the states and the localities for water transport. That is a law that was passed after the Exxon Valdez spill. And so just to, because I know that's another thing that there's, particularly
with all
when you
the
start
barge
talking
traffic,
about the gorge,
right.
When you start talking about the gorge, but that is something that there is actually, that was originally what we were trying to get to was something like that, the way that it's set up for water. However, because that was a specific federal law that allowed that to happen, we weren't able to do that in quite the same way for the rail traffic. So that is why we ended up going with this, putting that role through the state fire marshal.
Thank you. Mr. Kocher, just one last thing, and then I'll shut up.
Rep. Gorsuch, and then Representative Wisnett.
Perhaps.
Only if you promise.
Okay. Well, okay. For right now. perhaps it would be worthwhile, too, if we, the state, were to approach the federal delegation and try to get something worked out so that it would be a coordinated effort, very much like, you know, when you consider the National Scenic Area and all of that, but patterned after the barge water sort of thing. I think that would be something worthwhile in pursuing. Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I live maybe closer to any railroad than anyone on the committee maybe. Goes right near Sun River. Mm-hmm. And I've looked into this. And the policy issue, I want someone to be sure that I'm protected and my neighborhood is protected and all of Oregon's protected. Get into some financial issues. Fire Marshal, we have a hazmat. You already have staff to do that, but this is going to require an extra person to do this, and also I'm concerned about the training. Is that because the budget item is only $365,000, and that's to send someone to get this extra training to come back in and train other people in Oregon? Is that, could you comment on that, please?
Representative Wisnett, what this is primarily for is to help with the coordination between the rail, between all partners, on identifying those folks that do need training, and then there'll be a different funding source that we'll be utilizing to actually send them to that type of training. But that what's in the bill right now is primarily just for that person, for that coordination of all the policies of all of the planning processes.
Okay, follow up, please. But we already have hazmat. You have on your team or in the office have people hazmat trained because we're shipping military hardware, we're shipping other chemicals other than petroleum. And that's a different training. It's going to require different training, different coordination.
That's correct. Besides this bill, there's some other work that's being done by the rail, and the rail is actually offering up the equipment that they would need because it is a different type of equipment. We're talking, large quantities of foam. They're also offering up that training that is done specifically across the country. So they'll be offering that for these hazmat teams to take.
Thank you. Final question, Mr. Fletcher.
Yep.
So because the bill does talk about there's going to be a fee, Mrs. Roberts going to talk about that? Aren't the railroads being charged a fee? Is that, did I read that in the bill or not?
No, if I may, Co-Chair, Representative Wisnett. In the original draft of the bill,
there was
a fee that would be divided among the
railroads. I was going back and forth
there
trying
was some,
to figure
there
out.
Was some, that had some federal preemption issues and some interstate commerce issues. But what you do see in the amended version is the establishment of, and I can't remember the exact word, an oil by rail hazardous fund, which is opened but not funded. It would basically allow the department to apply for grants and other things, whether they're federal or from other areas, in order to buy additional personal protective equipment, whatever it is. It establishes the fund but does not fund that fund. It sets it up so that, because there's apparently a lot of training and other funds available that we could apply for as long as we have some place to put them through which we can utilize them.
Thank you. And I just put on the record, because I think both the good representatives that testified said the industry was supportive of this bill as it stands now.
Yep. And also, if I could briefly say about the coordination role, one of the issues that we heard in the discussion about this from the railroads as well, from BNSF in particular, talked about, they offer trainings, and then they hear back from communities, why don't you offer trainings? Well, we did offer trainings, but you, but nobody from your department came.
Good.
An important role that the fire marshal will play is to establish knowing who's been trained where there are gaps in there are enough people being trained. That's another important part of the role that the fire marshal
Thank you very much
play.
For that information, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much. And so the understanding is that industry is supportive of this. Nobody has signed up to testify, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3225 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2621 relating to photo radar. LFO. Yeah, why don't you go first?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, House Bill 2621 allows the City of Portland to operate fixed photo radar systems in urban high crash corridors as they're defined in the measure. Fixed photo radar systems must be in the same location for a minimum of 180 days. However, there's no limit on the hours of use. Currently, photo radar systems allowed by law in other municipalities are limited to a certain number of hours or specific areas like residential or school zones. There's some other issues that I can get into as far as estimating the fiscal, if we have a moment to
Dive into it, please.
The number of units operated by the city is not specified in the measure, and it's assumed that any of these units that would be put in place would be operated for 24 hours a day, a significant change from current law and other municipalities. The City of Portland currently operates one manned mobile photo radar unit, which produces approximately 30,000 citations per year, and that's operated in limited hours. The Judicial Department initially estimated about 55,000 additional violations in 15-17, but they're assuming a rollout schedule for the City of Portland to operate about four, two starting in January of 2016, and then two more in April. And then rolling out another group in the 15-17 biennium to total 20. However, the fiscal is going to totally be dependent on what the rollout schedule will be and how many of these units the City of Portland will operate. Currently, Multnomah County Circuit Court, which processes all the City of Portland's traffic violations, has 26 FTE in its violations unit, and they process 90,000 total citations per year. The revenue that comes from these violations, there's a 67% collection rate, and of that amount, 71% goes to the criminal fines account, with 29% going back to the City of Portland. It should be noted, though, that the CFA monies do not cover court operations and would not fund the processing of the additional citations received.
Okay. Fire away. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you, co-chair and committee. My name is Jeff Reardon, State Representative, District 48, which is outer southeast Portland down into Happy Valley. And there's nothing theoretical about the situation we're in right now. In on particular high crash corridors, which are there are 10 of them in the City of Portland, about three are in my district. And frankly, we're having way high percentage of deaths and injuries from auto accidents. And so that's what this is intended to address. I have the short version of my presentation. I'll give you that this afternoon. If you have questions, please let me know. And then Elizabeth Edwards is here from the City of Portland, who can answer all the hard questions. But basically, the bill, as was stated, it does allow the City of Portland to operate unmanned fixed photo radar. That is a change from existing law. These will be out there 24 hours a day. They're not meant to surprise anybody. They will have excellent signage, so drivers will be warned. And the difference is there's nobody there. The existing radar system has a police officer. They can only be on site for 4 hours at a time. So that's the change. And a reason for that is we really want to educate people. This is not, you know, see how many folks we can give tickets to. We want to change behavior in this area, and I think this is a great way to do it, where there's a constant reminder that, hey, we want you to slow down here. That's the whole message. And I'm going off my notes here just a little bit. I'm really going to be interested to see how this plays out, because yes, we will be increasing the number of units. Not we, the city of Portland, will be increasing the number of units over time. But if we're correct, people will learn that they're there. They will slow down. And so I don't expect to see a continued increase in numbers of tickets. Anyway, so as I mentioned, we are talking about the 10 most dangerous streets. These streets represent 3% of the roadways, but account for over half of the serious accidents. Serious traffic injuries and fatalities are disproportionately affect Portlanders as compared to the rest of the state, so that's why we're going to do this program in Portland, and disproportionately affect people of East Portland that I represent. Bill will make it easier to educate drivers about their speed and encourage them to drive safer, make better use of city resources, because it doesn't require an officer to be present in that van. But do keep in mind, please, that all the tickets will be reviewed after the violation, so there are human beings involved with this. And I think it really has the ability to save lives. As for the concerns of this committee, this bill has the potential to raise revenue for the state, because the statute requires the city of Portland to dedicate any additional revenues which are at the city level or expect. Anyway, it's going to have a positive fiscal, a net positive fiscal to the state. And $60 of every ticket goes directly to the state, and then after, whatever money is left over is split between the city and the state. So the hard questions, please ask my good friend from the city of Portland.
any testimony from the city?
Briefly. Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee. Thank you, Representative Gruden, for the introduction. My name is Elizabeth Edwards on behalf of the city of Portland, and I'm going to piggyback on what Representative Gruden said, provide just a very brief overview of the bill, and of course urge your support for House Bill 2621. As the representative noted, it would authorize the city of Portland to pilot the use of unmanned fixed photo radar on our most dangerous roads. In the bill, it's these roads are defined by their abnormally high rates of traffic fatalities and serious injuries. In Portland, we call these our high crash corridors, as Representative Reardon noted. There's a real need for additional enforcement options on these specific roads, and we've highlighted those. The purpose is really to change driver behavior, and we do this in part in the bill by providing ample signage. There's a requirement that there's going to be a traffic laws photo enforce sign in addition to a speed reader board. That's a change from current photo radar enforcement. There's not that requirement for the speed reader board. This gives drivers both the information and opportunity to abide by the law and not get a ticket. We're trying to be extremely transparent in this process, and to get people to drive slowly and more safely. The program's also designed with a lot of oversight. The city would be required to report back to the legislature once each biennium on the effectiveness of the program on traffic safety, the degree of public acceptance, as well as the process of administering the use of the system. The program is modeled off of a pilot that's currently getting off the ground in the city of Fairview to use the same technology for enforcement in school zones, which is why it's this kind of lengthy program. The end date is January 2nd of 2024. And finally, as the representative noted, before a citation could be issued, the photographic evidence would be reviewed by a police officer, so we would maintain officer discretion. Citations are mailed to registered owners or drivers, and the penalties and repercussions of a citation from a fixed photo radar ticket are the same as those if you're pulled over by an officer and given a speeding ticket. So if you're driving down Powell too fast and you're pulled over by an officer, that ticket would look the same as if you were caught on Powell with one of these fixed photo radar cameras. Leave you with a quick piece of data. Studies from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration have shown that these fixed photo radar cameras can reduce crashes by 20% to 25%. This is a significant reduction. It would have immediate positive impacts in our community. So for that reason, would urge your support of the bill, and happy to answer technical questions.
quickly before we go to the questions. There's one in Northeast Portland in Sandy and where?
So there are no cameras currently
installed,
but Sandy is a high crest corridor, and I can list them for the committee if that would be helpful.
Sure, please do.
82nd Avenue, 122nd Avenue.
When you fast, I'll write this down.
Barber Boulevard, Beaverton Hillsdale Highway, Burnside, Division, Foster, Marine Drive, Powell, and Sandy.
Okay. Marine Drive in where? Which
it's,
street do you know?
Yeah, it's the length of Marine Drive, but we are looking at only installing one to maximum two cameras per corridor.
Okay.
So actually there's a provision in the bill that would allow us to move the camera after 6 months because we're not looking at having camera after camera just littering a particular corridor. We want to be very deliberate in the process, and we don't want to, you know.
Well, I want to ask about the cost.
Further information, Mr. Co-Chair, if I may, that you might find helpful in your neighborhood is that these are not they're pretty easy to get by. They're calibrated at 11 miles an hour over the speed limit. Mm-hmm. So
now we'll see how many people listen to these here.
So those of you that are here tonight,
when you start listening, you know.
So those of you that are here today, you know, you get something out of this presentation. But,
and so it could be the stretch of Marine Drive anywhere in the city of Portland. Is that what the bill allows mm-hmm. for?
It would allow for that. Yes.
Okay. How about Gresham? Moving on out there. Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Number one, the Fairview bill was my bill, and they're still haggling over what they're going to do there. But I have heard some people talking about this bill going, oh, it's another Portland bill. The truth of the matter is that we have tried to have these statewide. And the research that we discovered when we were working on the original school zone photo radar, which I wanted applied to the whole state, was that it was somewhat arbitrary that the set of cities that were placed into the statute, that was probably not the true intention, that it should have been something that could have been done statewide. So City of Portland, you know, having worked, as Representative Barker did, in Portland, those streets are extremely hazardous, as anyone who lives in the city mm-hmm. of Portland knows. And so this isn't just designed to be a fix for the city. Personally, I think that we should allow this across the state in high crash zones. Secondly, there was an ODOT study that we came across when I was working on my bill, where they did exactly what is envisioned in the bill. There was a reader board up ahead. It said slow zone, work zone, radar, photo radar in process. And what they found was that it did truly slow people down. So I think that this is a very good bill. And anything that we can do to reduce the number of traffic fatalities that are occurring on these streets is extremely important. So thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Senator Bates, and then we'll switch back over.
A couple comments quick and then a question. First off, I really like this bill. It's about opposite what's going on in Medford. In Medford, they placed these are mobile ones. They placed them in the most likely places to get you. There's no accidents occurring in these areas. They actually have areas where the speed limit drops from 45 to 35 for two or three blocks. And you can expect that to be in there every other week. There's no accidents ever occurring in these areas. This is just a revenue source for the city, and people are getting pretty upset about it as we go along. I doubt it's going to change because they need the revenue. So this is complete opposite of that. You're sharing the money. You're putting up boards warning people, which is not happening in other parts of the state. And so you're doing I think, the right thing, and I'm very supportive of the bill. I don't know how people speed in Portland. I was there last night.
I got miles an hour.
It took me an hour and a half to get from getting off the freeway at Taylor Ferry Road to the Selwood Bridge. I timed it. It was an hour and 15 minutes. I could have parked the car and walked. So I don't know what the deal is in Portland, but it's maybe people speed somewhere. That said, as I read the bill, it looks like this exempts freeways. And I think it does. Two issues there. One, I do drive 205 a lot. Clearly, the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit there is, for people living in Portland, is a suggestion. And for the rest of us, it's 55 because, you know, I mean, I'm constantly holding up traffic, getting honked at and everything. So
I don't know how you're going to handle that part of it.
Are we making that a crime?
Yeah. Yes.
Question, and there's another spot at I-5 at Myrtle Creek where it's supposed to be 50 miles an hour because of some sharp turns, which are, and the reader board warns you a couple times. People chronically ignore it and crash there all the time, especially trucks. Is there something on interstate highways, this is the question, is there something on interstate highways that prevents us from doing this as a state? I mean, they need radar ticketing at the Myrtle Point area. Absolutely. When those trucks rolls over, we're stuck for 2 hours, and that's happened to me twice, and it happens all the time up there. Is there something why you couldn't go on to the freeways? Was some federal law or something involved?
Yeah. I don't know. Good question.
Co-Chair Senator Bates, it would need to come likely through ODOT, and I don't know if there's a federal issue with that potentially.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Barker?
I was going to say, when I was in the state police, we were radar on the freeways. You were on I-5. And I would expect that once this program gets in place, revenues will actually go down because you will slow them down and make the road safer. And the other thing I would say is you expect that whoever's looking at the photographs will see some people wearing pig masks and things like that for a while. So, for entertaining, they did that in Beaverton.
Yeah, would these become public records?
Co-Chair Senator Shield, the way that it would work is the images that are captured are destroyed within 30 days if a citation isn't issued. If a citation is issued, then the photographic evidence is destroyed within 30 days of the disposition of the ticket or 2 years, whichever comes first.
Can you do the same thing with license plate information? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. A couple of questions for Portland and then questions from the financial statement. What's it going to cost? What's the cameras going to cost you?
Co-Chair's Representative Wisnett, we don't have an RFP out yet because we're still seeking authorization. So we didn't want to be premature in that effort, and it would depend in part on how the contract was negotiated. We would want to keep with best practices and look at a system that did not encourage vendors to issue citations.
Thank you. The other question, follow up, Mr. Chairman, is, in the report we have, and Representative Reardon said something about $60. This says that there's going to be fines and citations will add additional revenue to the criminal fine account. City of Portland, the CFA will receive roughly two-thirds of the revenue generated, and one-third of the revenue would be received by the City of Portland.
Co-Chairs, Representative Wisnett, that's correct, and there's actually a requirement within the bill that says any revenues maintained by the City of Portland first have to go to maintaining the program and then beyond that toward traffic safety. It's approximately a two-thirds, one-third split, and it's because of how the criminal fines statute is written. So if, let's say, it was a Class B violation, someone were going 20 miles per hour over the speed limit, you would take the first $60 and then split the remainder 50-50 between the state and the city. So that's why it's approximate.
Okay. Thank you. Final question, Mr. Co-Chair. It's a significant cost to the court system that you've come up with on this. I hope the revenue offsets that or the amount coming. You're showing an $8.6 million, let's say $2.2 in 15-17 and $8.6 million in 17-19.
Chair Shields, Representative Wisnett, members of the committee, that was part of the difficulty in estimating the fiscal to judicial staffing is we just don't know when these units would be in place and how much they would produce in a 24-hour period without seeing some data first to estimate how much staff they would need. This was just the initial estimate provided by the Judicial Department, and it was a fairly conservative number of citations and revenue compared to some of the other results that we've seen in other places.
We may want to look at this in a couple of years and see how it's looking, if it becomes a financial burden. Safety is the most important. I acknowledge that. But if it gets to be out of hand,
I agree. Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. In relation to that, Representative Wisnett, one thing that you see is that in most cases, a majority of people who get a ticket don't go to trial. They just mail it in. So it's just the process.
I assume that's being part of the charge, too.
But the other thing, and you brought up something really important, in the city of Fairview, where they have a red light camera, and I think the plan, if they go forward, is to do this with their radar, is that you, the city or the county, whatever state entity, can actually work up an agreement with a vendor where they do all the maintenance and then they split the revenue cost so that it helps to reduce that revenue for the government entity, which might be a way to mitigate some of the cost of these systems if that were considered. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay, so the winners, and then we're going to move on.
How many cities now do we have the red light cameras?
It says 11 in the.
11?
Mm-hmm. They're listed out
in the staff summary.
Mm-hmm. Chair Shields, Senator Winters, members of the committee, in your staff measure summary from the policy committee, it does reference 11 cities in Oregon that are permitted to use photo radar devices to enforce speed limits. I don't know if that is specific to include red light cameras themselves. It might be a separate.
I believe those are separate.
Yeah.
Well, Medford's got both. Some others might too.
All right. I think we'll move on to the next bill then. Thank you very much.
Thank
we appreciate you coming to testify. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2621. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3503.
Yeah, sure.
So we can throw bombs at
you. Yeah, really.
We no wonder it's tough.
They're still trying to I
can talk about that. Okay. Before we go, Rep. Williamson, why don't we let Ms. Gilbert tee it up for us, please?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3503 establishes the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program in participating counties. I will not read further description of it because I'm certain that with the public testimony, we will hear further description of it. I will say that this has been scheduled today for a public hearing and possible work session, and in order to be absolutely deliberate and thorough, the Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending that the work session, that we carry over and have the work session tomorrow and the public hearing today.
Before we go forward, Representative Williamson, I made a big mistake and forgot that OJD was in the room to testify on the previous bill. So I, if you don't mind, if they want to testify, they can. Are they gone?
No, we're here.
Okay. My apologies, colleagues. I will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2621. My apologies.
It's okay. I appreciate
right
being asked to come to the table. Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is David Factor. I'm staff counsel at the Oregon Judicial Department, here to testify related to House Bill 2621, the fixed photo radar bill. The Judicial Department doesn't have a position on the bill, but we do have one to express some concerns with the bill, the way it's currently drafted. I think Mr. Turpening did a nice job of sort of outlining some of those issues. We are struggling currently to develop a fiscal impact statement related to the bill. There is a significant workload to the courts for these citations that come from photo radars. The revenue stream anticipated from the bill depends on the court being able to process that workload. We do not know, in fact, we just heard for the very first time this afternoon, how many cameras the city of Portland thinks they might want to use, and how many locations they might use throughout the city. There are 10 high crash corridors in the city, as you heard described. They are lengthy. It's the entire length of Marine Drive. It's 82nd Avenue. It's Sandy Boulevard. Those are miles and miles long. There could be multiple cameras throughout the course of those. Legislative Revenue Office estimated approximately 96 citations a day per camera, an average of 4 citations an hour over 24 hours. That's about 36,000 citations a year. Today, we get about 30,000 citations a year from the mobile photo radar units that operate in limited locations, limited hours. So one camera would more than double our current workload for the Judicial Department in handling these cases. There's many steps in handling these cases. It's not like everyone who gets one goes online, makes the payment the day they receive the bill. The statute around these allows people to offer an affidavit of innocence and or a statement related to liability. The affidavit of innocence is typically they get a citation in the mail and they say, it wasn't me driving, it was someone else, I lend it to my brother. They send that in. The court has to deal with those issues. Similarly, on the affidavit of liability, typically a rental car company says, we had rented it to somebody else, it's not our ticket, it's the other person's ticket. The court is required to dismiss those citations against those people who were cited. The citing agency could then reissue to the person who was driving the vehicle, but that's another bit of workload related to those. In the current experience, about 25% of the cases are dismissed as a result of those affidavits of innocence and certificates of non-liability. So there's a significant amount of work in these cases. It's not as simple as just collecting the money. Every single one of these has to be reviewed by our staff. Some of them, about 10% of them, currently do end up in court in front of a judge. People come to the counter. People make phone calls because they don't remember getting the ticket. How did I get this? I wasn't even there. They end up spending a lot of time in court staff dealing with these citations. So our concern is being able to understand how many locations may be established, how many citations we can then expect to come from those locations. And to date, we don't have that information, and we can't reasonably develop a fiscal impact statement without that information. Ms. Daly, Kimberly Daly from our department, has some more detail on the steps involved in processing those citations.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kimberly Daly, staff counsel with the Judicial Department. As David said, these cases aren't as simple as plead and pay or you go before the judge. There's a number of actions that courts take on these cases, including scheduling and conducting trials for those who want to challenge their tickets or request that the judge reduce the amount of the fine, reviewing driving records to determine possible eligibility for reduction of the fine, working with defendants at the counter and on the phone, provide interpreter services for defendants as needed, enter judgments, receipt cash payments, set up payment schedules for those who cannot afford to pay in full, process default judgments against persons who fail to appear, take collection action against those who fail to appear, including processing license suspensions and notifications to DMV when the suspension is lifted, processing paperwork such as letters from defendants, preparing and sending citation abstracts to DMV, and then there's also some work done by our central accounting office here in Salem to transmit payments to the state, city, and county. And photo radar cases in particular generate a lot of additional court activity because unlike a traditional citation case where the officer personally serves the citation to the defendants in these cases are receiving the citations at least 6 business days after the incident occurred. They get the letter in the mail. They don't know why they're receiving it, what they're supposed to do. So these cases generate a lot of questions and phone calls to the courts. And then also the court has to process these certificates of innocence and affidavits of non-liability. And there also are other issues other than staffing that we need to address when we're talking about a significant caseload increase. We would use this as an opportunity to examine our business processes and work with the cities to see if we can find some efficiencies in how we process these cases. That's something we would do anyway, but if this bill were to pass, this does provide a perfect opportunity to have that conversation. And also, we need to make sure that we have enough office space for court staff. The county is responsible for providing court facilities. As many of you know, Multnomah is currently in the process of building a new courthouse, and they are looking for a new home to place their violations bureau staff. That staff would not be housed in the new courthouse. They are currently having that discussion as we speak, and so they are going to need to know what additional office space they would need. And I do just want to echo the comments that Mr. Terpening made in regards to the revenue impact. The revenue from the new cases would go to the state's criminal fine account or the city of Portland. The statute specifically directs how the legislature allocates funds from the criminal fine account. Those funds go to public safety standards and training programs, crime victims, the state police, and LEDs. None of the funds from the CFA go to support court operations. And so in order for, one of the things the revenue statement does is that it assumes that there is sufficient court staff to process these cases. And to ensure that occurs, we would need an appropriation from the general fund to ensure that we have the appropriate staff in place. We thank you so much for your time this afternoon, and we're happy to answer any questions that the committee has.
And we're happy to continue working with Mr. Turpening and LFO staff in the city of Portland on this bill.
Okay. And any questions for OJD? All right. My apologies again.
No, it's okay.
All right, so now I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2621. And I've already opened the public hearing on House Bill 3503. Representative Williamson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Colleagues behind me are the experts on the programs that we're going to talk about. I just wanted to set the stage quickly for this bill. My co-chair and I have been spending a lot of time, along with other colleagues in this building, trying to wrestle with the increase of women in our correctional system. In Oregon, women are the fastest growing inmate population, and about 80% of them, between 75 and 80% of them, are moms. So that's an issue that we need to deal with in this state. And the bill before you today is based on a Washington model, a Washington program that allows parents convicted of certain nonviolent offenses to receive intensive supervision and services while they are remaining in the community with their kids. We know this is important, and that keeping families together as opposed to taking a parent and taking the family apart when mom or dad goes to DOC. The impact on kids is significant. Children of incarcerated parents are 80 times more likely to need a higher level of service than other children, and 41% of children in foster care have a parent who has been convicted of a felony. So we know that there are devastating impacts on families when mom or dad goes to prison. So this Washington program offers participants mental health and addiction treatment, life skills training, and counseling, and other services designed to strengthen the family while holding the offender accountable. Of the 120 people who successfully completed this program in Washington, between July 2010 and January 2015, only 8 have committed a new felony. So it's a very, very successful program. The intention of House Bill 3503 is to model this program while allowing flexibility to test structures that would work in Oregon specifically and in our communities. This bill creates a program to be piloted in Marion County, Multnomah County, Washington County, Deschutes County, and Jackson County. The three larger counties were selected, frankly, because of the number of women that they send to Coffee Creek, and the smaller two to give us a better idea of how this program will work in rural Oregon. Each of these counties will receive funds for either a full or half-time probation officer to focus on these specific cases, and it's our expectation that these officers will have a smaller caseload, between 30 and 35 per year in larger counties, where in Multnomah County right now it's 60 people per parole officer, probation officer, and up to 15 for the smaller counties. This bill also funds a program coordinator within DHS to assist with child welfare cases, as well as to help coordinate services for the children and families in the program. And it's our hope, frankly, that this is the beginning of a conversation of how we serve these families better. Whether it's services through DOC, DHS, community corrections, we know we can be doing a better job for the more than 2,000 children in Oregon who have a parent in prison right now. You know, it's our hope that we get these families the services they need so that we can stop intergenerational incarceration. Thank you.
All right, well said. I think this bill is perhaps the most important one that will come before our subcommittee, just because we're so close to the line at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. If we don't try to intervene and divert some women away that can make it, and those that can make it in the community, we're going to be up to our eyeballs and having to open up another prison. All right, good job. Let's bring up Jeremiah Stromberg and Jeff Wood.
Name of their program.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, Chair Williamson, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg. I'm the Assistant Director of the Community Corrections Division with the Department of Corrections. You do have our DOC position in front of you, so let me just highlight a couple of points in regards to this bill. We are here in support of House Bill 3503 today, and I want to start by thanking Representative Williamson and her staff. The level of collaboration, the use of data, putting outcome measures and modeling this after a proven program is what is going to make this program successful and give us the ability to truly drive an effective family alternative sentencing bill. This bill does require the Department of Corrections to establish the program in partnership with the courts, community corrections, and DHS. And we have a proven history of making those partnerships successful, and so we look forward to assuming that role in this bill. This bill continues the focus on community programs and exactly for the reasons that Chair Shields described. It will continue to provide accountability and public safety in a smart, effective, efficient manner, an approach that aligns itself with our Justice Reinvestment Initiative already. This will allow us to continue to reinvest locally and not have such a heavy reliance on our prison system. And those community programs, time and time again, are proven to be much more effective than our prison-based programs. And so it's for these reasons that the Department of Corrections supports this bill, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions you may have.
Good testimony. Next. Yeah.
Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Wood. I serve as the division commander with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I'm also the vice president of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. As on behalf of the Marion County Sheriff's Office and OACCD, we are in support of House Bill 3503. Not to reiterate what the assistant director had mentioned, but just to along with the other counties mentioned, Marion County, we have taken substantial steps towards this program and successful completion of this program. We believe in the program. We have met with the district attorney who supports the bill. Marion County Sheriff Jason Myers supports the bill. We've met with the Criminal Justice Commission. We've had discussions with the Department of Corrections. Met with the Washington State Department of Corrections to talk about their programs. And the Department of Human Services Child Welfare. We have a process map that we have submitted to Co-Chair Williamson on the process that is loosely based off our other prison diversion program, our 416 pilot. And we have an existing unit that we believe would augment or work very well within this existing program. In short, we believe we have the structure and resources and community support to make this bill come to fruition, be successful, lower the recidivism rate of this nonviolent property type offender population, and hopefully help the Department of Corrections with pressure on their institutional structure. So with that, I will conclude my testimony, and I am available for any questions if necessary.
Can I make a comment? I just want to thank Marion County at every level who's been supportive of this and have really taken a look at the female population that they send to the Department of Correction, taken a hard look at it, and I think this is going to be a fantastic program in this county, and I know you guys are going to do a great job with it. So thank you for stepping up.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I mean, since it's in my district, I can't help but brag. But because I also have to add to the support for this program is our county commissioners and also our business community. We've got probably one of the best champions from the business community in Dick Whitnell. I need to give kudos to my county, not only on this initiative, but if you look, we're also leading the pack on talking about mental health and jail diversion, We were committed to 3194 when prior to its initiation, when we actually did all the work on 416. My county decided that even though we did not pass Senate Bill 416, that they were going to work on and implement it anyway. I am so proud of my public safety community and my county commissioners and the leadership in Marion County. So I just need to say that for the record, that, you know, when a problem exists, they roll up their sleeve and try to figure out how we can solve it. So all a right. Big thank you.
And I also want to give some kudos to Commissioner Cameron, who is in the back there.
Yeah. Well, I didn't see him back. Oh, that's my son. Where is he? Oh, there you are.
Does Devlin know about that?
Well, yeah, he's the father.
Yeah, I should know.
Senator Bates.
Just some quick calculations to see if I'm in the ballpark here. He used the numbers from Washington County for avoided costs. Looks like you need about 45 people in the program, and you've broken even right at that point there. Anything above that, you're saving money, not counting the savings of having to go up another institution, not counting the savings of foster care. Would these primarily women be allowed to work while they're in probation in the county level?
Community corrections, folks?
Sure. Co-chairs, Senator Bates. Yes, the program is going to be designed in a manner to address the significant needs and risks of the individual. And so for some, they may not start out working, as it wouldn't be appropriate as we address, say, addiction needs. But over the course of the year, the goal will be self-sustaining offenders who are able to move out of the program. So some will begin working right away. Others will address more important needs initially.
Follow-up question. We're rolling out some programs through DHS that include education, training people for the workforce. I assume they'd be allowed to enter those programs too once their mental health and drug and alcohol problems are being dealt with. I'm making that assumption.
Senator Bates, co-chairs, members of the committee, yes. The short answer is yes. As Assistant Director had mentioned, we would assess for criminogenic risk factors. We would treat the addiction. We would treat the mental health. And once those issues have been stabilized and, say, parenting classes are completed, we do have on-the-job training programs locally in Marion County. We have a very good collaborative with Schmeckede Community College. And so all those resources that we currently have available to the population or a like population would continue to be of service to this population as well.
Well, and Senator Bates, it's my hope with having someone in DHS and in DOC focused on cross agency services that we would be doing more and more of that than we are now. And I hope our savings looks like Washington. Our program is a little bit different. The primary savings will be in not opening Coffee Creek, but also in the efficiencies of using our system in a more effective way. I think is where we're going to see hopefully the bulk of the savings. But community corrections is less expensive than DOC.
Your savings are very conservatively being measured here. I think they're much, much, much higher than you're thinking they are. They're probably two or three times higher, at least, possibly more than that. And since I come from the DHS world, where we spend this money like this, like water, well, maybe water is a bad choice now, but we spend it very quickly and easily. Being able to work inside with corrections, public safety, and DHS is kind of a new revelation for me, so we're going to work with you. Okay.
Excellent.
And just for the record, to further talk about the collaboration that's going on and with the directors group that I have working, and that is DOC and DHS, as well as the Oregon Health Authority and OYA, I think it is critical that those collaborations, this project and others initiative, because clearly, and I'm glad that you joined us in public safety, we understand there is the nexus that from the Department of Human Services as well as OYA and all of them, and bringing them all together is a win, and I think ultimately, because I think foster care also is a pivotal piece of this, because you will find a lot of the women either have their children in foster care or a grandparent or somebody else is responsible. So I think this is a good initiative, and I think one that I think we all can really vote for and watch the outcome of, you know. So I want to thank the chair and Representative Olson for bringing this forward, and I'm very glad that you consulted with my county.
And as we move forward with this project, I think the one piece of caution that I would be concerned with is that we do more than just hire a special probation officer, mm-hmm. more than just hire a DHS caseworker, and then have the same kind of services. I think we're going to have to really invest into some very high-quality parenting programming to make sure that those wraparound services are there, because the worst outcome is to set these women up for failure.
Right.
Great. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can we bring up Chris Edmonds and Elizabeth Kishwa?
Co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Edmonds, and I'm the Government Relations Director for the Department of Human Services. I don't want to belabor the point because you've heard a lot of good testimony already on this bill. But I think that it's worth noting that a little bit less than 2 years ago, I had coffee with Representative Williamson, and she said, "Hey, what do you know about kids who end up in the foster system because they have a parent who's incarcerated?" And I said, "That's a really good question." So I'm really pleased, very proud to be sitting at this table right now, testifying in support of this legislation. The Department of Human Services wholeheartedly supports HB 3503. This is a positive piece of legislation, and it represents forward thinking, a collaborative approach to strengthening and preserving family bonds that are so critical to child development. We find that the trauma experienced by a child when they lose their primary caretaker is significant and can follow a child for life. What this legislation does is it allows parents who are capable to continue to safely parent their children while taking responsibility and being accountable for their criminal activity. One of this bill's strengths is that it forges state and local partnerships with agencies that touch the lives of vulnerable families. We recognize at DHS that many families will come into contact with several jurisdictions during a time of crisis, each with its own set of responsibilities, policies, and requirements. And what this bill does is it creates partnerships focused on delivering efficient and effective oversight and services to keep the family intact and promote long-term family stability. Under House Bill 3503, DHS is going to work with these local corrections agencies and the Oregon Department of Corrections to provide confirmation of a parent's current or prior child welfare involvement and consultation around program eligibility and ongoing service requirements. DHS will continue to work with the other agencies throughout the family's involvement with the child welfare system with the goal of improving outcomes for children and supporting family stability. HB 3503 represents another tool that child welfare has to access, that we can access to equitably and safely reduce the number of children in foster care. So again, I'd like to recognize Representative Williamson and I believe the other 36 co-sponsors of this legislation for bringing this bill before you today. It's very innovative. It's an approach that has worked in Washington, and I would urge you to support it.
I have a question.
Senator Winters.
Will DHS have, and I'm going to go back to the professional staff and that staff that's capable, assigned to actually be a part of this?
So the plan as it stands today is that this bill would appropriate a single position in DHS field services that would be responsible for coordinating a statewide implementation of this bill. That person would be in charge of program design internally, as well as coordinating between the Department of Corrections and the community corrections departments on policies, procedures, and processes around this program. What we would anticipate is that this bill would leverage existing services through strengthening, preserving, reunifying families.
The actual thing to do.
Hmm?
I raise that question because a critical component is in this is to make certain that the casework level does the casework's job in meeting the needs that's going on the other side. So when we talk about the level of service, I just want to make certain that exists.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, absolutely. That's a critical component of this program, and your point is well taken. Our expectation would be that this bill will increase the communication and coordination between DHS, the family, and the corrections agency. So that way, we're avoiding redundancies in service delivery. We're aligning our service delivery for the family in a way that's going to create successful outcomes on both the criminal and human services side of their involvement with the state of Oregon.
Okay. Senator Bates.
I'll talk to you offline.
Okay.
I'm not sure all it needs to be done. All it needs to be done is this kid should be automatically placed in differential response. Right. That does it. The way we place people in differential responses are at risk or in a situation where the courts are involved. Obviously, the courts are involved here. If these kids are automatically placed in differential response, all the services you just talked about are there. Mental health, drug and alcohol for the mother or the father, usually it's the mother, support for the children, up to and including housing. This is not a hard thing to do. They should be just dropped into differential response and call it good. You know, if you put 50 kids in this program, you're going to save $1.5 million of avoided cost of foster care.
Go ahead, Senator.
And I agree with the good senator, and it's making certain that we don't have that the staffing that's responsible for this is actually bringing and marshaling those resources and not coming up with, oh, wait a minute, I got to dot this I and cross this T, and it ends up into a lot of paperwork processing so that there's those delays. I, you know, totally think that the differential response system is there. So I'm trying to figure out, in addition, you know, recognizing that your staff actually, or the staff, the line staff, will actually, it's a new dimension for them, that they will actually go into this with the understanding that this is a go.
Absolutely. I would agree with everything you said.
And one other thing I might add is that obviously there's huge overlap between the criminal justice population and some of the child welfare population, the parents who are involved. But there are some distinct differences in working with the criminal justice population generally, just degree of antisocial personality disorder compared to the general population. So that DHS caseworker might need some training on the criminal justice side that they might not get in the DHS world, and I'd be happy to talk to you about what little bit I know about that, having been in the social work profession. Good. We're good? Oh, Representative Krieger.
I think Mr. Edmonds has learned very quickly it's best to agree with everything says.
I think he probably learned that his first day on the job.
I agree with everything you just said.
See, he does. He's got it.
Yeah, well, I think there's certainly challenging times in child welfare, but I think the one of the things that gives me a lot of hope is the degree of legislators who have been foster parents and who genuinely and deeply care about these topics. And I think there's, you know, nowhere to go but up. And I've been, just over the last couple of weeks, been very pleased with DHS's reaction, not just to this, but to Senate Bill 632 on upskilling foster parents. So I think that's just such a welcomed participation with us, and I'm excited about where we can go. So thank you, Chris, for your work. Ms. Kushwa.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the Strategic Director for Children First for Oregon. Children First, we strive to make systemic change, long-term change, through policies and programs that strengthen families and help keep kids healthy and safe. As Representative Williamson stated, over 75% of the women in prison are parents, over 7,500 parents in the general DOC population. In 2013, nearly 500 children, foster children, had an incarcerated parent. We really appreciate having a children's perspective into this bill, not just the offenders and the treatment places. We understand the importance of intensive intervention into families, including parenting classes and other partnerships. There is national data, the Nurse Family Partnership, I'm sure you may have heard of, did a study through home visiting. And the parents who went through home visiting, the women who went through home visiting, were twice less likely to have another felony conviction. But I think more important for the purposes of our state and this committee, their daughters were 9 times less likely to have a felony conviction by the age of 19. That is long-term systemic change and worth the investment that you will make in this program this day. We also appreciate the fact that this is going to give you an opportunity to quantify the programs that are out there. Maybe there will be tweaks at the end of a year or two. That's an important thing we need to know, so that we're keeping the children safe and the parents on the right track. I would also add to Children First support of this bill that the Oregon Foster Youth Connection, who is, I think you've all met the foster kids, they're youth-led, just voted on their legislative committee, and I believe you may have their testimony now, also to support this bill as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you again for listening to the kids.
Representative Williamson.
I want to start by thanking Elizabeth for coming up and giving voice to, there's a letter in support, and you'll notice, in addition to Children First, Stand for Children, Mercy Corps Northwest, a whole bunch of folks who we don't usually see in this committee. So thank you for taking part in these conversations and making sure that we had a children's perspective in this. And while I'm talking, I want to thank DHS, CJC, DOC, Community Corrections, and Madeline, my staff. I actually threatened her with we weren't going to have any testimony except for hers, because she has put this puzzle together in a way that we weren't always sure we were going to get it together. And Linda has been great, too. So I'm really excited about this program, and I just needed to give a shout-out to everybody who stuck with it. Every time we had a new wrinkle, we may have some tweaks in the future, but everybody is excited about doing this work. So thank you all.
And also, Amanda in my office did a great job as well. And I think, we've talked, at least Representative Williamson and I, about this bill complementing 939, which would be kind of the restartup of the Family Preservation Project, and then hopefully we will also fund more children's programs at DOC, perhaps in the next biennium with the policy option package, should DOC come forward with one. But I think, we have an obligation to walk and chew gum at the same time, that we not just divert people, but we also, for the mothers who are going to have to be incarcerated, that we do the best we can to tie their kids to them while they're there, and make sure that when moms come out, they hit the ground running on day one and are competent and ready to parent. So the last thing that I want to just take note of is you talked about the nurse home visitation program, and that is a high fidelity program that costs a lot of money. And I think, again, I would just want to underline that we can't do this on the cheap. And I think we're going to have to pay attention to this program all the way through. And if we have to spend a lot of money to get good outcomes, it's much better to do that than to spend half as much money and get horrible outcomes. So I think I'd like to keep track of this through the interim, and maybe when DOC comes and reports to us on how close we're getting on beds, we can couple that with some of these reports on how this program is getting off the ground. Nice job, Representative Williamson. Okay. Would anybody else like to testify? All right. Wow, we actually almost went to the end. This meeting is adjourned. Anything for scheduling?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I will close the public hearing. Thank you. On House Bill 3503 and close public hearing on
it over.
And carry it over to tomorrow for work session.
And tomorrow you have work session on the Oregon State Police. That is your last budget through. House Bill 2205 returns, House Bill 2002 on profiling returns, and House Bill 3503, this returns.
For work sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And nothing else you need to roll over, right?
I think so.
Okay, we're adjourned. nothing else I need to roll over, right?
I don't think so.
Okay, we're adjourned.